We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Reverend Catherine Kuzmel, who is the brand new pastor, just 1 month in the pulpit at the First Presbyterian Church of Urbana. Welcome, Catherine.
Thanks. It is great to be here, Steve.
And you've come from Raleigh, North Carolina. Did you bring a southern accent with you?
I don't think I did. We'll find out if I say y'all too many times.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, a Pittsburgh girl and big old Steelers fan. I probably bring some Pittsburghese. You'll hear me saying slippy and gum bands. Grew up there and found my way to the College of Worcester in Ohio, and a lot of Worcester connections around here as well.
College of Worcester, and then where did you go to seminary?
I went to Duke Divinity School, which is what makes me a big Blue Devils fan, which I know is very dangerous in this territory. Yeah, I'll cheer for all teams, ACC. And then finished up some doctorate work a couple years ago at the Aquinas Institute in St. Louis.
What did you specialize in there?
Preaching, homiletics. Yeah. It's a grand opportunity to do distance learning and to really think about what it means to be a preacher.
Now, we're going to be talking today about what the challenges are for a new minister in town at a new congregation, a new community. And I appreciate your being willing to talk live on the radio with listeners about your experience so far and your hopes for that. Were you prepared for that at all in seminary? Did they talk about what it'll be like when you first went to a congregation?
No, not a clue. No, they sort of, they put you in these field ed placements, and if you're fortunate, like I was in field education, you work with really skilled pastors. And I think I got my feet wet after I graduated from Duke. I moved to Northern England for 2 years and served in a United Reformed Church there. And they taught me so much about community and grace and how to get to know people and a lot about what it means to be church. They just sort of showed me all the ropes the first time. And then in my previous pastorate here, just be in a community that's nurturing and giving. But when you come ahead of staff for the first time, some things you know well and are easy, and other things the learning curve is steep.
Sure.
Yeah.
So some of our listeners may be undergraduate students here at the University of Illinois or at other colleges. Of course, this program is heard in Illinois, Eastern Illinois and Western Indiana, as well as on the Internet all around. So there may be students many places who might be considering seminary. When you were an undergraduate, did you know early on you were going to go on to seminary and become a pastor?
That's a great question, Steve. People ask me what I think about God, and I always say that I think God is persistent and insistent. I think I felt early calls to the ministry probably when I was 16 and doing some preaching in a little town in western Pennsylvania. And I'm fortunate to have had female role models in ministry, but boy, I did not want to be a pastor.
What kind of a church were you growing up in?
I grew up in a Presbyterian church in the suburbs of Pittsburgh. My family, very active. My parents were both elders.
That's an elected position in
the
Presbyterian
church.
Yeah,
thank you. Uh-huh. But I just didn't want to be a pastor. Couldn't figure out how I could continue to be me and to laugh and be a little sarcastic and flippant sometimes and be a pastor. So I tried a bunch of other things. I taught for a very short teaching career of 12 weeks. I tried the nanny gigs for a while. I had decided I'd be really content being a nanny and working in a grocery store at night. And it was actually my brother-in-law at one point who finally just said, "Would you just apply to seminary and get this done?"
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I sort of said, "Fine, I'll apply to Duke," and really smart people get into Duke. Mm. And so I figured I wouldn't get in, and lo and behold, persistent God kept pushing and shoving.
What had you studied at Worcester?
I studied music education with a minor in religious studies.
Yeah. So the religious thing was an interest.
It was very much an interest, yeah. As much as I didn't want it to be an interest— I kept connecting with people and meeting with professors there who just really let that be alive. I worked in churches, 3.5 of the years that I was at Worcester, in nurseries or as youth directors, and sort of the theme kept coming back and pulling me back onto that path.
Now, you also chose to go to a church-related liberal arts college rather than, say, a big state university like the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
Right.
So was that partly because of an interest in things religious, spiritual?
Gosh, I've never thought about it that way. I think I really chose Worcester because I knew I needed a small liberal arts school. I knew it.
Just personally.
I knew that for me, you know, the option for me would have been Penn State at that point, a school that size or like here. It was just massive, and I would have been lost. You know, and I really celebrate being in a school with small classes and the opportunity to be pushed and known by professors. And
that happens at larger universities, too, because students fit into sort of small groups within a huge university, if they're lucky. Now, some never find that small group. For some, it may be a fraternity sorority. It may be a living unit, a learning living residence hall or something, or it may be focused around an activity, a particular passion.
Exactly.
I was director of the university YMCA, and a lot of undergraduate students sort of found a small niche there, a family, a place where you were known. And
Where it's okay to be whoever you are.
I'm making it sound like the Cheers bar, but
where everyone knows your name.
But it does help to have a supportive group around you. And you learn a lot from those folks.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, I learned so much more than just what was in the books. You know, people who shape your lives and coach and nurture. And, you know, after my folks moved from Pittsburgh, there were several years that I was at Worcester without family real close by. And to have, you know, in the music department, it was sort of, it felt kind of like the faculty took turns deciding who was going to invite all of us orphans over for big meals. And so there was always a place. Like you say, always a niche, a place where there was great love and support.
And, of course, campus ministries exist in large state universities like here at the University of Illinois. And that can be also places. They've been very important here since the Dean of Students about 110 years ago really encouraged the various religious groups to somehow locate some kind of a group on campus. Maybe it's a congregation. Maybe it's another type of campus-focused ministry, but that's been very important for students here on this campus for years. Well, let's talk about your experience in seminary. When you got there, were you surprised?
Was I surprised?
Anything that was shocking? Or let's see, did you take a course from, who are some of the wilder professors at Duke?
Stan Hauerwas is the big wild one. But no, I didn't study with him.
Speaking of being careful what language you use on the radio.
Exactly. He can pull some, can't he? You know, Duke was, I intentionally chose Duke partially because it was close to Chapel Hill where I was living. But at the same time, I chose Duke because I wanted a big school, as opposed to Worcester, which had been small. I was really most interested in going there and taking classes and doing field education and working a couple part-time jobs. It's interesting to me that I was thinking earlier about the faculty who I really connected with at Duke. And I connected a lot with Beth LaRocca Pitts, who is no longer there. She's a Methodist minister serving in Georgia somewhere. She taught an intro-level course. She taught Hebrew Bible, and she actually taught two semesters of summer Hebrew, so kind of in the trenches with her. And then a great New Testament scholar, Bruce Fisk, who taught Greek, and I think who held my hand through most of Greek both semesters.
So in your particular denomination, are you you are required to take both Greek and Hebrew in seminary, so you can have at least somewhat of a knowledge of the language in which both parts of the Bible.
Yeah, I think that's the intention, that we'd have a knowledge. Yeah. One of those things you have to keep it up and use it all the time. It's hard to do that with all the other pulls.
I can remember Baruch Atah Adonai. That's about it.
There we go. There we go.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Reverend Catherine Kuzmol, the new pastor at the First Presbyterian Church in Urbana, which is located on the corner of Green and Orchard Streets, very close to campus, on the east side of campus. She came to this position from a church in Cary, North Carolina, a large, still-growing suburb of Raleigh, North Carolina. If you have a question or a comment, we're eager to have you join this conversation. I can ask questions all day, but we're happy to have other people with a different perspective also join in. The way to do that, if you're in Champaign-Urbana and it's a local call, punch in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it's long distance, including if you're listening on the internet, punch in 1-800-222-9455. And our good engineer, Kyle Crow, will answer the phone and put you in line to talk with our guest today, again, Catherine Kuzmel. Kuzmel, what sort of a name is that? What's your family background?
It's a German name. And for those German scholars who might be listening, you probably know exactly what it means. And it probably pushes the limits of radio for me to talk a whole lot more about the meaning of that name.
All right. Yeah. So only our German listeners know.
They will, or we'll all have something to Google online later tonight, right?
So, German family in Pittsburgh. What kind of, did you have pastors in your family?
Great question. No pastors that I remember in my family. Two gentlemen who I'm probably not at all similar to. My great-great-great-grandfather and my great-great-grandfather were Presbyterian pastors. They also happened to be the first two presidents of King College, which is a small Presbyterian school in Bristol, Tennessee.
Huh. So they helped found it, or they were called by others to be the pastor
the president? I think, Dr. Tadlock, who was the first president, I think was in there on the ground running. And, you know, it's fun to read back and find out what you hear about them. One of the great things that's always said about him when you read history about him is that people did not understand him, which is kind
of
scary when you think about a pastor. Or I don't know what, he was on my mother's side, so he wasn't German.
Oh,
I think he was just way too scholarly for the pulpit. Yeah. So you think, oh gosh, as a preacher, I hope I don't inherit that characteristic.
You're interested in preaching, and you mentioned that your doctoral work at St. Aquinas Institute, was
Aquinas
that right?
Aquinas Institute,
focused on homiletics, on preaching. Who are some of the influences on you? What people influenced you in terms of choosing your pulpit style, your preaching style?
My preaching professor at Duke was Bill Turner. And one of my favorite stories about Bill Turner, we were in the preaching lab, and I don't know if this was the case for you, Steve, but when I was in seminary, you'd prepare all these sermons, and you'd preach them in these tiny little rooms for about two people, like the room that we're in now. And I got up to preach.
And in front of a video camera.
Exactly, in a video camera, and totally fake and totally. And I started to preach, and I had my text in front of me. I was very nervous. Bill's a very dynamic preacher. And I started in, and he put his hand up from the back of the room, and he stopped me. And he came up and he slammed his hand on the pulpit and he said, "Girl, are you going to preach or are you going to preach?" And I looked at him like, "I don't know. I think I'm going to preach. I don't know what the answer is." And he asked me again. He asked me a third time and I was flustered and you know how fair-skinned I am because you're in the room with me. So I was totally red, beet red. And he took my manuscript and he ripped it up and he said, "Now you're going to preach." And that freedom from him to know that it's my authentic voice. And that God calls all of us who preach to preach in our own voices. So surely there are people who influence and shape us as preachers, but it's so much for me a process of what is God speaking in the text? Where is that with me? What do other scholars say about the texts? So Bill Turner's a huge influence.
Well, Catherine, if that would have happened to me in seminary, I would have walked out and never returned. Because I was always tied to a manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
I would write the words, and then I would read the words, and I'd worked real hard on those words.
Right.
And for decades, that's the only way I preached. Mm-hmm. It was only in many years that I could preach in a way I found acceptable to myself, sort of from an outline or from notes or from memory.
The interesting word I think you used, Steve, was the word and how important the words are. I went through a phase earlier as a preacher where I just preached from an outline.
Uh-huh.
And what I found, and folks who've heard me preach for a long time will remember this, is I had several years where I just couldn't ever get to a point. I just sort of circled around and around, and I couldn't get there. And so I moved back shortly before I started my doctoral work to preach for manuscript.
Oh, really?
Because the words do matter.
So you've done both.
I've done both, yeah.
How do you decide today which you're going to use?
I almost always stick with the manuscript.
You do these
and
things.
As a new preacher in town, I'll use a manuscript for a while. Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know what your experience in the pulpit is, but for me it's such a humbling task to proclaim the word, such a position of privilege, and for me it's a responsibility that still makes me very nervous. I know the first Sunday that I get up to preach and I'm not nervous, that'll be the last Sunday I ever preach.
Uh-huh.
It's a big responsibility.
Uh-huh. We're talking about what it means to be a new pastor. Where was your first sermon to a congregation?
My first sermon, this is a great story, was in a small Presbyterian church in Ebensburg, Pennsylvania. It's, east of Pittsburgh, maybe an hour and a half. When you stand in the pulpit and the doors are open, you can look out, and I think it's the county jail that you can see across the street. And the doors were open that day, and I was...
The doors of the church?
The doors of the church were open, yeah. Hopefully not the doors of the jail too much. And as I was preaching, I could see prisoners being led in and out. I was preaching about a summer experience that I had been in Alaska. And I was talking about what it means to be 16 and in a place where you're the only blonde on an island and people are peering out from behind the curtains to see you.
You've been in Alaska. You mentioned you've been in England.
Mm-hmm.
Have you served as a pastor elsewhere, out of the country?
No, just in England.
I guess Alaska is not out of the country.
No, not quite.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Let me give the phone numbers again for listeners who'd like to ask a question or make a comment. Eager to have you do that. 333-9455 is a local number. 1-800-222-9455. We're talking with Catherine Kuzmel, the new pastor at First Presbyterian Church of Urbana. Spell your last name for our listeners.
It's K-U-S-S, like Sam, M-A-U-L.
And am I pronouncing it close to how you would say it?
Pronouncing it in the closer to the German way. I always coach people to say it's like swearing at the mall, cuss mall.
And people
tend to remember it that way.
Okay. Yep. Well, I'm sorry I've been saying
that. I should have corrected you, but I figure lots of people understand what swearing at the mall might look like.
Cussmall.
Yep.
Catherine Cussmall.
There we go.
Well, I'm sorry. But we've just met, so.
We have.
These are the kind of things you learn.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying Steve exactly right.
Perfect. I practiced a bunch all afternoon.
So you've preached four times at the First Presbyterian mm-hmm. Church of Urbana. That's a historic church in this community, just so you'll know something about me. Mm-hmm. My wife and I were married there.
Wonderful.
A few years back.
Mm-hmm. Not too many.
After she'd finished her master's here at the University of Illinois in microbiology. And neither of us were members there, but I had grown up in a independent, very conservative church, and I had been accepted. No, I had not been accepted at that point, but I had applied for Presbyterian Seminary, and I knew I respected the denomination very much and had been impressed with what it had done in the realm of civil rights and peace in Vietnam days. And so I'd sort of chosen the denomination, even though I'd never been a member of a Presbyterian church.
Wow.
But because that was what I thought my future might hold, we asked the pastor there if he would perform our wedding, and he was very gracious and was willing to do
that.
Who
was the pastor then?
Well, I'm afraid my memory is slipping at the moment. I know it sometimes, but at the moment I can't remember.
Well, I just think back, and I know Phil Giddings was the interim just before me,
right.
And Don Mason had a long-term pastorate.
Yes.
And then before Don, I think the previous installed pastor was Jim Dowd.
Yes, I knew Jim Dowd well. Mm-hmm. He was pastor when I came to be pastor here at McKinley Church in 81.
Mm.
So I've known several of your predecessors. And, of course, Don Mason died tragically just a year ago, and he had been interviewed on this program by phone when he was out at Ghost Ranch three or four weeks before his tragic accident and fall. But that's not an omen for you. You're, I'm sure, going to stay very healthy. We have a couple callers waiting. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Catherine Cusmall. Yes, line number one.
Yes.
Yes, go right ahead.
Welcome to our community.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
There are many interesting and helpful ecumenical and interfaith opportunities. I wonder what, how would you describe the principal gifts and uniqueness, unique attributes of the Presbyterian tradition?
That's a great question. Thank you. You know, I think one of the great gifts of being Presbyterian is our polity or our form of government. I think what it creates is a way for individuals and congregations to really be heard and feel like they've got an active role. You know, I think about even the way that Presbyterians call pastors. You know, committees are formed to bring a candidate, a nominee, and then it's an entire congregational meeting that calls a pastor. I think one of the other things that I just love about being Presbyterian is the old Reformed phrase that gets thrown around a lot. I think it's ecclesia reformata semper reformanda, maybe. I'm looking at Steve to help me, and he's not looking at me. And it translates something.
Our caller says that's correct.
Oh,
great.
Yay, perfect. It translates the church reformed, always being reformed, or always to be reformed. And what I think that opens us for is this awareness of the Spirit and the fact that the church is called to be a vibrant, dynamic place where we engage society and where we respond to what's happening around us. I think that gives us freedom to honor a tradition, to celebrate who we are as Reformed people, but also to stay as contemporary as we can.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, caller. And our caller was too polite to ask the follow-up question, which is, what's a significant weakness of the Presbyterian denomination?
Oh, I think we're slow sometimes.
Okay.
You know, I think sometimes the slowness makes us very intentional and allows us time to discern. But boy, sometimes it can bog us down.
Take a long time. We have another caller waiting on a long-distance line, line four, a caller from Holly Springs, North Carolina.
Yay, someone from home.
Hi, Catherine.
Hey, Mary. How are you?
Good. I'm just making dinner with Julia, and we want to know your favorite thing about Urbana so far.
It's pronounced Urbana.
My favorite thing about Urbana so far, Mayor, is the joy on the kids' faces is beautiful.
That's very cool.
And, Mary, they've got great restaurants. And they've got a network that's devoted to the Chicago Bears. I know, it's wonderful. I did watch them last night. I thought they could do better for you. So you need to come see me. Come soon.
We will. We'll see you soon. It was great talking. We're listening to you.
Love you, Mayor.
So Mary, before you're hanging up, how could you possibly be a Chicago Bears fan clear out of North Carolina?
We're all from Chicago.
Oh, okay.
So we're transplants.
Okay.
Well, she was from Pittsburgh.
I can't imagine anyone wanting to move from Chicago to North Carolina, but we'll forgive you.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Bye, Mayor.
We have another caller waiting on line number two. Yes. Go ahead, caller. Line number two.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Catherine.
Hey.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. So this is a conversation Catherine and I had a little bit earlier, but I would like her to talk about, if possible, well, two questions really, Kat. The first one is, can you talk a little bit about what it's like to be new? Because I think that's interesting for folks, especially in a pastor position, because that's, a really unique position to be new in. And then the second one is, the one that's always near and dear to my heart is your thoughts on children's sermons and how those are going in your church.
Thank you very much. Two questions. First, what's it like to be new? You're on display every Sunday up in front of a lot of people sitting there looking at you.
It sure does. You know, the interesting thing about being new is I'm aware that people know me and I don't know them, so I never know in town who knows me and who doesn't know me.
That's tricky.
The other thing, it's so hard to be new is, you know, you come to any new place and you're trying to figure out all of the dynamics of a staff and of a congregation and of elders and, you know, the other elected officers of deacons and trustees and trying to find your way. The other big tricky thing, and I'm so grateful to our office manager, Tracy, for helping me with this, is getting names. And so she's taken the church directory and turned it into flashcards for me, which has been really helpful getting to know, connect names and faces. You know, I think being new, I want it to feel right now like it felt after 9 years in Cary. And it just takes time. And everything's a question about how do you do this? And everything's a trying to balance when you offer your ideas and when you just sit back and graciously listen.
But there has to be some excitement with that, too.
Oh, there is. Yeah, there's, you know, lots of folks to meet and stories to hear and faith journeys to hear about, which is exciting and fun, and people who are eager to get to know you. I think one of the great gifts of being a pastor is when you move into a new position, there are people who want to get to know you. I think of times when family members of mine have moved and have felt really lonely, and it's different as a pastor. You move, and they're here in Urbana, there are 350 people immediately who are eager to connect, which is so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
So children's sermons, is that the other thing?
That's the other thing.
Right.
Because we talk about them a lot.
We do. We talk a lot about children's sermons because they've got a very special and significant place for me as a preacher. I think when I was working on my thesis, if I hadn't gone the direction I did, I would have talked about what preaching looks like with children. It's such a treasured, special time. It's not a time to be used for announcements. It's not a time to talk to adults. It's really a time to engage children in conversation, to be using their language and being in their world and letting them speak and find a voice. Just today the children and I were talking about hospitality and what it means to be hospitable. And I asked them what it feels like to come into the church and to give them a chance to really think and be present and understand that that they are church in this moment, and to really honor that time with them. I'm a real believer in object lessons and real conversations, and Kathy, the caller, knows this. Sometimes I get a little frustrated when I feel frustrated is not the word. I cringe a little bit when a congregation laughs really hard at something a kid says. I know why they do it, because it's fun and beautiful and they want to encourage the kids. But I try really hard not to, because sometimes that young person is saying something that really matters to her or really matters to him. And just to honor that time to set it aside. I think I've often been critiqued of having children's sermons that are too long.
Well, you know what? I think the other purpose of the children's sermon is, and this is really kind of a silly one, but I think it's really probably rings true, is that especially when it precedes the sermon, It really kind of unpacks the text a little bit in a very simple term for the congregation before you get to it.
I think you're exactly right. When they're coordinated well, when worship is linked well with themes that weave in and out, you can sort of foreshadow what's coming for adults.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. And I think that helps.
It does.
All right. Well, take care of yourself.
I will.
We miss you here.
I miss you, too. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Another caller from North Carolina. It's easy to do that. There are two ways. You could call on the toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Local lines are available at 217-333-9455. So if you're within the 217 area code, just punch in 333-9455. And, of course, if you're listening at will.illinois.edu, you may use the toll-free number as well. And if you've missed part of this program or would like to hear other programs from the past here on Keeping the Faith, there is a good archive kept there, and this program will be there within a day or two, actually. We're getting quite efficient with getting these programs archived. So if you've missed part of it, want to hear it at your convenience, you can do that on your computer. Just go to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And we say keeping informally here without the G. It wasn't my choice, but that's what we ended up with. So that'll get you to the webpage that will show you all of our guests, and you can put in a search name or topic or a date, or simply flip back through and find the program you'd like to hear. My name is Steve Shoemaker. We're about halfway through our program. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, I'll be traveling, and Don Nolan, a professor of philosophy of religion from Parkland College, will be our guest host, as he often is. And Don will be talking with John Eby from Parkland about gay politics, local and national issues. That'll be John Eby with Don Noland here on September 5th on Keeping the Faith. September 12th, social worker Shirley Stillinger will be talking about the homeless, mentally ill. Author Don Kurtz will be our guest September 19th, talking about his fascinating novel, Churchgoers. September 26th, Rafe and Jessica Malhado will be our guest. They're the new interim staff at the Hillel Foundation at the University of Illinois, the Center for Jewish Life, the Cohen Center. So those are some of the programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith in the days ahead. Again, we'll get back to our guest right now. And let me try one more time to get your name better.
You can do it. I know
Catherine
you can.
Catherine Cusmall.
You got it. See,
Cusmall.
Now you're just thinking about being in the mall, walking by all those stores and sometimes the other things that come out.
Not something I do very often. Let's talk again about being a new pastor. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about how you use the Bible. You talked about dealing with a text from the Scripture and presenting it as a children's sermon and then also as a homily, a sermon for adults. Do you use the lectionary? Do you go from a topic? Do you preach series of sermons? Do you go all the way through one book in the Bible till you finish it? What do you do?
I tend to be a lectionary preacher.
Tell listeners what that means.
Yeah. There's a big book of literature called the Revised Common Lectionary. And what that is some methodical way over 3 years to work your way as a preacher and as a congregation through most of Scripture. It doesn't tackle everything. There's some texts that it avoids fairly clearly, I think, and some that sort of tiptoes around. But what it provides for me as a preacher is a structure. So in each weekly lectionary, there's an Old Testament or Hebrew Bible reading, a psalm, usually a gospel reading, and an epistle reading, one of the letters. And the reason I preach lectionary most of the time, not always, but most of the time, is it's a good discipline for me. It makes me look at texts I'd rather not look at. It makes me tackle with letters that make me uncomfortable. And I think as a leader of a congregation, it helps the congregation hear more texts as well.
Now, some of our very astute listeners who are in the Christian tradition probably realized that you preach from the lectionary when you mentioned that your children's sermon this morning dealt with hospitality, so they know you preached from the 13th chapter of Hebrews.
Did I preach from Hebrews?
No.
I preached from Luke this morning.
Oh, you chose the gospel.
And the parable
lesson, but it's the same theme.
Yep, of the humble and the host.
Same theme.
Right,
okay.
Yep. Indeed.
So how do you pick out of those four parts of the Bible which one to focus on? You chose today Luke.
I did. That's a great question. I think I've really been shaped by the woman at Aquinas Institute who became my thesis advisor, Mary Margaret Pasden, a brilliant Dominican woman who really pushed us into a process of preparing for preaching that was called Contemplo, Studeo, and Predico. And I'll unpack those a little bit. The Contemplo process begins even before you open Scripture, and it's a process grounded in prayer, thinking about the needs of the world, the needs of the community, your own thoughts and goals and sense of call as a preacher, and then it takes you to the texts. It's a fairly spiritually grounded discernment process that, for me, allows one or two, sometimes three of those texts to really bubble to the surface, to sort of create a place to preach from. And she really says, honor the spirit within, ask your own questions. I'm often a preacher who will look at a text in three or four translations and see what issues bubble to the surface. I think about whose voices aren't heard in a text. What would an onlooker see? And it opens up a whole freedom to approach a text. That then when you come around to the studeo, which for her is doing the study, looking at other authors, looking at other scholars. Gosh, Steve, I think it's awfully spirit-driven. Often it just flows together and it's clear where you're going for me. And it's also clear the weeks that I don't do the process quite so well.
We have another caller waiting on line one from Urbana. You're on the air with our guest today, Catherine Cusmall.
Hi, Kat.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. It's good to talk with you.
Thank you. Can you? I have two questions for you. Can you tell me how you have been received as a female pastor in a profession that has historically been male-dominated, and also how you handle some of the gender stereotypes?
Sure. I can tackle that. I have been received beautifully well at First Presbyterian in Urbana.
But you are the very first senior pastor who is female.
I am the first female head of staff there. The reception has been gracious and warm and kind. And truthfully, it makes me so proud of a pastor nominating committee and a congregation who's willing to take that prophetic step to call the person with the gifts and skills and talents they think that they need for a congregation, to sort of put aside what their comfort level is, maybe what their history says about who a head of staff is, and to be prophetic and bold. I think, and I'm so aware that I'm in the honeymoon stage, but I think what works well as a female pastor is for folks to have time to get to know you, to experience you in the pulpit, to experience you in fellowship. And it doesn't need to be an instant, this will be my pastor. That can be a growing experience. It's part of that journey of faith that I think lots of times if someone has never had an encounter with a female head of staff, it's scary and it's new, and sometimes that fear can take over. And hopefully, as I can come and continue to walk alongside, it'll help folks who are feeling uneasy to work through that. I know that was the case in Cary. When I started there, there were folks who really struggled as an associate pastor there that I was female. But, you know, time and walking the journey is a very, very helpful thing. And then gender stereotypes. Can you tell me more what you're thinking about?
Oh, like, are you expected to make things for staff meetings?
Are you a cook?
Normally the pastor's wife would normally be in charge of.
Right. Oh, that's a great, yeah. You know, it's luckily I haven't bumped into any of that here. And I think what helps here is this is a highly educated community. Really brilliant, gifted, grounded folks who are in a university setting, you know, and for me it was important when I was looking to move to an area where there were lots of other female clergy, where it was an educated place who would really be receptive to who I am, although I clearly come with my gender, not who would be open to me as a pastor, not necessarily as a female pastor. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
It sure does. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
All right, bye-bye.
Appreciate the call. Other callers are welcome. 333-9455 if you're in the 217 area code. Several local lines. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455. Catherine, do you prefer to be called Kat?
Those nearest and dearest to me always call me Kat. That was a nickname that came with nephews. Lots of these callers have, haven't they?
But yeah. Catherine is spelled with a K.
It is.
Okay. And so K-A-T is a nickname, and you welcome that, but you introduce yourself as Catherine.
That's right. I always introduce myself as Catherine.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll stick with Catherine, at least for now. Maybe after 10 years, who knows?
We'll be best buddies, and I'll be Kat. And I'll have a good nickname for you, Steve.
Naming is a powerful thing, and what you're called matters. Do you prefer to be called, when you're introduced to a stranger, Reverend Cusmall, Reverend Dr. Cusmall, Dr. Cusmall, what?
You know, I was...
Pastor Catherine?
I was visiting with a woman, a member of the congregation, several weeks ago, And she asked me the same question. She said, how am I supposed to introduce you? And I struggle with that because sometimes I feel like all those titles create a lot of distance. And I just don't, the distance is challenging for me. So on the business cards, it always says the Reverend Doctor. But when folks introduce me, I love it when they're able to say, this is Catherine and she's the pastor of my church.
We have another caller on line number one. You're on the air.
Hi, Catherine. This is Bob. One of the questions that arose this morning, because I noticed that you'll be teaching some adult education starting September 12th, what do you think of the challenges of adult education in the church today?
Wow, Bob, that's a great question for me. You know, I think the challenges of adult education in the church are much the same as the challenges facing the church. You know, what is it that we're teaching that's relevant, and how are we teaching things that people are first interested in coming to and B, find significant and important for their lives of faith outside the church? I think those are key. I think one of the big challenges for adult education, I was talking with a department or committee about this earlier this week, is how is it that we can do intergenerational adult education with folks who are young parents the whole way up to folks who are, you know, in their 80s and 90s, and how do we facilitate that? How do we find a way to have dialogue about why church? Why is church important? Why is faith important? And where are we engaging people? You know, I think far too long we've sort of, church culture has sort of been in a place where we say, oh, people will come to us and people will be engaged in church. And there have been generations of churches that haven't had to do much. Here comes a dirty word for some people, evangelism. They haven't had to do much of explaining why church is important and why it matters to them. And I think, Bob, we're in a different place. I think we really need to be thinking about what is it that people want. I tend to think that people want relevancy. They want a sense of community. They want a connection to something that's bigger than themselves.
And a follow-up then, so in what degree do you think that adult education today needs to think of itself as countercultural, that is acknowledging the kind of odd American culture that we now find ourselves in? Or is that going to radicalize too many people to think of ourselves as countercultural?
You know, I think the phrase countercultural is hard for some folks. I hope it doesn't radicalize too many people when I lift up, I think, the reality that that's exactly who Jesus was, countercultural. You know, Jesus was the one who went to the well at midday when it was hot and you weren't supposed to be there. And Jesus was the one who sought out the woman at the well and spoke to her. You know, Jesus was the one.
And that was scandalous.
It was scandalous, right? You know, and Jesus, you know, went into the table that we were talking about this morning from the Gospel of Luke and said, stop eating on and stop gathering on places of status. You know, figure out how not to bolster each other up and move beyond status symbols and the way society is structured. So I don't know if it's I'm not sure, Bob. I'm talking in circles here with you a little bit. You know, but I think countercultural is at its core so much of what Christianity has been about. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we try to domesticate it a little bit and calm it down. I don't know.
Well, good. Well, thank you for responding to that. And I, for one, am very grateful you've come to be our pastor.
Thank you, Bob. I hope we can talk more about that one.
Sure.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Catherine, I want to jump back a minute. You said earlier when you were at the Aquinas Institute that you were taught preaching. In fact, your advisor was a Dominican sister.
Mm-hmm.
So here you went to an ecumenical seminary, Duke, with Catholics and Protestants and interfaith even, people from other faith traditions. But then you chose to go to a Catholic institution to specialize in preaching, and you were taught by a sister who could not be a priest, and
right.
yet she can preach.
Correct.
Talk about
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, one interesting thing about Duke, I think we often confuse the divinity school with the university. And in the divinity school, it is fairly ecumenical, but mostly Methodist. So there's lots of Methodism in the land of Duke. You know, when I was looking for a doctorate in preaching, it was really clear to me that I wanted a degree just in preaching. A lot of the doctor of ministries in our country are kind of liberal artsy. You take a preaching course, you take a church administration course, you take a pastoral care course. I also knew I needed to be able to do it distance-based. And I had heard several Dominican preachers who continued to impress me with the spirituality of their preaching, the depth of their preaching, but also their commitment to actually communicating in a way that is clear and effective.
You'd been like to retreats with Dominican...
I'd never been on a retreat, but I'd heard them preach a lot on podcasts, actually, a lot of that. So the opportunity to study in that setting in a program that was really trying to grow its ecumenism and trying to expand to women was a great opportunity. And to work with a female preacher who is a strong, confident, creative preacher who has pushed up against some of the gender issues that one of our previous callers talked about was a real gift to me. In fact, I am thrilled to say that Mary Margaret will be in town for my installation. I have invited her to preach. So if you're looking to hear great Dominican preaching, it'll probably be in October on a Sunday afternoon.
Now, you've been preaching for 4 weeks already, and you're going to preach another four before you're installed. What does this mean? And I want to get to a call real quick.
Okay. Installation is this, how do I describe it? It's a
formal ceremony.
It's a formal ceremony that sort of officially, this is a bad word for some people, officially marries me to the congregation. It's a sort of, I'm their pastor and this is the congregation and we're off and running.
Okay. We have another caller, this time from a town near Urbana called Tolono. Line number two, you're on the air.
Hi, Catherine.
Hey, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. And you did a perfect lead-in to... I have a comment and a question
for
you.
Perfect.
My comment is that it seems like a lot of North Carolina folks from the Carey Church are listening in. And so I want to say thank you for helping shape you the last 9 years. Perhaps cheerfully sending you is the wrong word, but graciously.
No, that's the right word.
Sending you to us, and I hope that they will come out for your installation. Our congregation would certainly be happy to have them here. So consider that a formal invitation to anyone listening from across the country. Second, my question is, in all jobs, there are issues with burnout working too hard in this culture of Blackberries and email wherever you are. As a pastor, and I'm the daughter of a pastor, I would imagine that burnout issue is especially high. And so how does one go about establishing a balance between work and nurturing a congregation of 350 people and also making sure that you have time to nurture yourself?
Well, that's a great question, Sarah. You know that's one that I struggle with a lot. It is so easy to work too much. And the risks, I think, of a pastor working too much are the sort of burnout piece, which is part of it. There's lots of new research just out of Duke about clergy anxiety and clergy burnout and clergy stress. And the other thing that I think is problematic when a pastor works too much is it means she's not equipping the congregation well. If things are always falling to a pastor, it means that I'm not saying, that the elders aren't saying, that the deacons aren't saying, here are opportunities, friends, come alongside us and work. When I think about coming here to Champaign-Urbana, one of the things that excited me about balance was the tradition of athletics in town, of the tradition of great music in town, of the Cranert Center, of being in a university town where it feels like I'll have great opportunities if I take advantage of them, which will be the key, to recreate and to relax and to kick back.
To actually have a Sabbath yourself.
To actually have a Sabbath myself, yeah. Yep. And the other big challenge is sort of identifying those folks in the community, some in the congregation, who can really be safety nets for me, places where I can go and really unwind, which I think is vital for pastors. I think if we don't have a small group of folks with whom we can just really let down and breathe deeply, I shouldn't speak for all pastors. If I don't have that, I get worn out.
Well, I hope we don't wear you out and give you chances to breathe and recreate.
You guys are already giving me chances to breathe and recreate. And you know, I was as I was getting ready to come today, I thought, oh, what if Steve asked me that dreadful question of what do pastors do for fun? So I actually took notes because I'm really bad at answering that. And so one of the things I put was, you know, great food and wine and conversation and laughter and play. And I even think about playing with your boys, Sarah, you know, them being in my house and jumping on all the mattresses in the house and what play looks like and how I have so much to learn from those who are much younger than me about how to relax and laugh and have fun.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you for the call. You let people from your congregation come to your house?
I let Sarah and Nate and their boys come to my house. I have known Sarah and Nate back since, actually before they were in college. They were 2 years behind me at the College of Worcester. But I met Nate, who is Sarah's husband, when I was at Worcester rooming with his sister. I went home for a weekend and there was Nate in the backyard and I quickly became able to tease him and play with him, and lo and behold, here they are in Champaign-Urbana.
What sort of a extended family do you have?
I am one of four children. I'm the third. My oldest brother lives in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and is a professor at Muhlenberg University. He teaches computer science there. He is married to my sister-in-law, Lane, who is resourceful and creative and bold and has been here and has taken me to some great food spots in town. And they have two kids who are creative and vibrant. Ben and Janie are a delight. I wish I had pictures to show you, Steve. I couldn't show the audience. I have an older sister, Kimberly, and she teaches at Carroll University in Waukesha, Wisconsin. She's a history professor there. And she has three boys. She's got twin 15-year-olds, Thomas and Morgan, and an almost 10-year-old, William, who, for people who are on Facebook, William is the one who made the Lego video that I posted a couple days ago. And then my youngest brother is Craig, and he lives in Fairfax, Virginia.
How do you decide who you allow to be your friend on Facebook?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think one of the struggles on Facebook is well, it's not a struggle, it's a gift. These things called privacy settings can be very protective and can be very helpful on Facebook, especially if you're concerned about privacy issues, which I think we all should be. I want to be able to personally know anyone who friends me on Facebook. There's only one person on Facebook who I don't know personally, and it's actually a fellow alum from Worcester who I thought I knew, and then when I accepted their friend request, I wasn't sure, but it's turned out fine. So I'm friends with youth and young adults and college students and adults of all ages on Facebook. Facebook. That's an interesting thought, isn't it, Steve? Of, you know, church people and non-church people and college friends and high school friends. And what a great tool that we're given for networking and relationship building.
How does a new pastor use the new media beyond Facebook?
Beyond Facebook.
Do you put your sermons on YouTube? Do you?
I don't currently YouTube. I've started talking with a couple of folks already at the church about how to make better use of website. It seems to me in North Carolina, gosh, it was something like 60% of the people who found our church found us online. And so having a website that's engaging and plugged in, we always posted sermons on that website in Cary. So I'm really excited to see, and I know the skill and the knowledge and the expertise is in the Urbana congregation, for us to have that be a tool that really lets us reach out and get people knowing who we are.
We're down to our last 4 or 5 minutes. We could still work in another phone call or two, 333-9455 in the 217 area code, long distance 1-800-222-9455. Just ask you, keep your questions short since we're running a little close on time, but we can still squeeze in one, maybe two. So do give us a call if you want to ask a question or make a comment with our guest, Catherine Cusmall, the new pastor at First Presbyterian Church in Urbana, Illinois. It's a university town. Cary is not really. You're part of a big metropolitan area that includes several colleges and universities. North Carolina State University, of course, is a large land-grant institution like the U of I. But my guess is you may have had some professors, some university staff, some students at your Cary Presbyterian Church.
Mm-hmm.
But here you'll have an overwhelming number.
Much more here, yes.
Tougher questions?
Until today, they haven't been quite so tough. No, you know, I love that, and I think it helps me grow as a pastor and as a scholar, hopefully, and as a lifelong learner in the community. You know, to have folks who are asking the questions that I have to say, I don't know, or tell me more about that, or can we think more about that? That's a great gift of this community, and one of the reasons I really was eager to look for calls in university towns.
Do you see yourself as a preacher who mainly inspires, exhorts, encourages folks, or teaches them, or something else, helps them grow spiritually?
Gosh, I wish all those Carrie people could answer now. You know, I think for the most part, in my most comfortable place, I'm a pastoral preacher. I'm a preacher who's willing to talk about stuff about fear and loneliness and where it is that we find room. And occasionally I'll get pushed to the prophetic end of things.
We have a caller from Carrie.
Yay, someone to help me.
Yes, you're on the air.
Hello?
Line 4, you're on the air, yes.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Catherine, this is Fred.
Hey, Fred, man. How are you?
I'm doing great. Now I'm doing better.
I'm sure you are. I miss you.
I miss you, too. What I was going to ask is, do you feel like this was a major step in your faith journey?
Thank you for the question. Go ahead, Catherine. We'll cut off the caller because we are getting close to time.
I do, Fred. A huge step in my faith journey. A journey, gosh, Fred, why do you ask those questions that make me cry? It's, you know, it is scary. It feels sort of Abraham and Sarah-like to leave a place that you love and a place that loves you and to step out to a place where you know almost no one and you keep kind of wanting to say to God, no, God, I don't, that's scary and that's unknown and that's new and God keeps calling and with me, it's sometimes God keeps pushing and kicking me in the rear end and say, no, go. It feels like a huge step in faith. It feels also in a very deep, deep place, like the absolute right place for me to be. As much as I, you know, can be teary when I hear voices from North Carolina, and as much as I can miss people, you know, I think of Teresa of Avila, who had that vision of the hazelnut in her hand, and all shall be well, and all shall be well. And I know that this is the right place.
We've been talking today on Keeping the Faith with many folks from where Catherine Cusmall was pastor in Raleigh and Cary, North Carolina. And she's the new pastor here in Champaign-Urbana at a church very near the University of Illinois for the First Presbyterian Church on the corner of Green and Orchard in Urbana. If people want to find out more about that church, there is a website, which is
www.first, spelled out, F-I-R-S-T, firstpresurbana.org. There's also a Facebook page. I think it'll come up if you're on Facebook if you just type in First Presbyterian Urbana.
I want to thank callers, and next week here on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking, Don Nolan will be interviewing John Eby about gay politics, local and national issues. Thanks for listening.